This is The Ink Spot with Stanley G. Robertson. This is the show where we talk about books. I am your host, and today we are going to be discussing the book entitled Surrendered, The Rise, Fall, and Revelation of Kwame Kilpatrick. Kwame, welcome to The Ink Spot.
Hey, thanks for having me.
If we start off from the top, it seems that during the time that you were mayor, some issues came up, some things happened. What was it that caused you to leave office?
Well, first, let me just say that the book was born out of a womb of a dark, cramped space in a Michigan Department of Corrections prison in solitary confinement. I ended up after, you know, traveling the world, being the mayor of the city of Detroit at 31 years old, speaking at Democratic National Conventions, being in South Africa, all over Europe, all over this world and country, to being in a solitary confinement cell. And you know, I put myself there. I need to say that. I was involved in a romantic relationship with my chief of staff at the time, and there was a totally unrelated lawsuit against the city where, in an unprecedented way, the judge allowed for the mayor to actually testify in that trial. It was related to police overtime and other things.
Now, when you say allowed the mayor, are you talking about yourself?
Yes, yes. The mayor had never, you know, there are hundreds of lawsuits, so no matter what city you're talking about, whether it's Detroit, Chicago, Philadelphia, there are hundreds of lawsuits per year that happened in that town. And when someone sues the city, they attach the mayor's name. So if you look at, you know, you have a new mayor now, but if you look at Mayor Daley or if you look at the mayors of New York or Philadelphia, Detroit, their names are attached to any lawsuit against the city. So this was a lawsuit against the city, and my name was attached, and the judge in the case allowed for me to be put on the stand and be, you know, deposed and put on the stand in the trial of this police case. And I always say 60 seconds changed my life. There were all three stations, local stations in Detroit. It was live on television.
Are you saying that the result of that trial is what happened to you?
No. Listen to me, Stanley. In that trial, I said that 60 seconds changed my life. I was asked on the stand. I was on the stand 5 hours, but three questions I was asked on the stand at the end of my testimony about something totally unrelated to this. I was asked that I have a romantic relationship with my chief of staff, and I said no. And, you know, did I send text messages to my chief of staff, and I said no. And it was a third question, and the result of that, I was lying. I lied under oath. And about 3 months later after that trial, the text messages were released to prove that I was lying under oath, and then a prosecutor, for the first time in Michigan's history, prosecuted me criminally out of what happened in a civil trial. And so I was prosecuted for then perjury and eventually pled to obstruction of justice, and had to resign my job and lose my law license and other things. And that's what happened in the city of Detroit. A lot of people think it dealt with embezzlement or money or different things like that, and had absolutely nothing to do with it. I lied about an affair under oath, and it ended my career. My betrayal of my family, my misleading the public and the city of Detroit led to my downfall and led to my ouster from that position as mayor of the city.
I don't want to make any assumptions here, but when you lied about that, was that just because you were caught off guard or you just didn't want your wife to know about what was going on?
Well, yeah, both of those, but ultimately I was, you know, stupid, didn't have any business involved in that relationship in the first place, but mostly, yes, you know, with all three cameras, three stations locally, didn't want my wife to find out in that way. I also definitely was caught off guard and didn't want the city to find out anything like that in that way, and I thought that it had nothing to do with what was going on in the trial, but mostly stupidity, Stanley.
So you attribute that to do you attribute that to your youth?
Absolutely not. You know, I hear this a lot, but Stanley, it's a lot of old guys right now cheating on their wives listening to this program.
Right.
It's a lot of guys lying to their wives right now. out of hand. As surely as we know some young, dynamic people who were prepared for positions that they were in, we know some old fools. And I don't believe that has anything to do with age. Now, spiritual maturity may come into play, and it's something that we definitely have to look at. You know, I had a responsibility of 1 million people, $3 billion budget. And to this day, I don't believe that there was a mayor that ran the city functions better than I did. We fixed more streets. We built more parks. We hosted more large events. I mean, Detroit hadn't built a hotel in 20 years before I got there. We built seven
hotels.
How
old were you when you became the mayor?
I was 31 years old. But as I was saying, we built seven hotels in 5 years. We hosted the Super Bowl, All-Star Game, Major League Baseball All-Star Game, G8 Summit. So it wasn't the job, but Stanley, I would agree that it was a problem in maturity on how to balance the job with family, with faith. You know, how to make sure if you're diving into this job, you're also keeping connection with your wife and family. And so that imbalance, I believe, it's a role of maturity that's played in that I did not have at that particular time. But I don't believe that's due to age either. I think that's more of spiritual maturity and not just walking the earth longer.
Now you're saying spiritual maturity. You use that term a couple of times here, and actually throughout the book, you refer to that as well. So I would ask you now, are you a Christian?
I'm a Christian. I've been a Christian since birth, yes.
The young lady who you had the affair with, the text messages were back and forth between you and her, right?
The ones that were pertinent to this case that we're talking about, yes.
Right. So why did you hire her? In the book, there was some discussion about her being hired as your first chief of staff, but then it seemed that some folk around you were saying that she lacked the experience. She wasn't ready to be the chief of staff. Why did you hire her as your chief of staff?
She was my chief of staff in the state house. She was the person who managed all my campaigns, from the state house campaign to my leadership run. I didn't just grow to be mayor. I was elected to the state house at 25 years old. I was the first African American and the youngest person to ever lead our Michigan state legislature. She ran my first mayoral campaign, the second mayoral campaign, and she was an excellent chief of staff. The issue of the affair didn't take away from that. There was nobody. I believe in the beginning that people questioned all of our ability to be able to do our jobs at 30 and 31 years old. But I think, you know, 6 months into the position, she was well equipped and well prepared to be chief of staff. She did some things in the city that have never been done before and hadn't been done since. She was an excellent person in that job, so that wasn't the issue. Mm.
Yeah, sounds like you accomplished some great things as the mayor of the city. Then you went on this trial, and as you stated earlier, the charges or the things that ended up ruining or wrecking your career seemed to be very minor. I mean, obviously, lying under oath is a serious thing. You're a lawyer, so you would know that. But why do you think they were so hard? Why did they? This was your first offense in terms of the criminal justice system. You'd been the mayor. You'd done all these great things for the city. What was going on there? Why did you end up in prison for such a long stretch of time?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I got caught up in the midst of what's been Detroit's storied history for so many years. You know, I gave people the rope to hang me. Detroit is a very, very racially segregated region. The city is about 85% black. The suburban communities around it are about 85% white. We've had three huge race riots in the city. It's constant conflict, and now, as you can see, the city is probably going to be the largest city in America to actually go bankrupt and have an emergency financial manager. And I was caught in the midst of that turmoil when I came in, and I provided some of this myself, Stanley. I wore big suits, gator shoes. I had an earring in my ear, and I was telling people we can play bigger than that. We are better than we've been. We won't be the butt of jokes nationally and internationally. And I thought that ego and pride that I thought was Detroit pride and Detroit ego, and I called it a Detroit chip on my shoulder. It really pissed some people off. You know, it was racially separating. I was bold about saying that I'm giving 70+% of the access to contracting in the city to African-American companies. I firmly believe that if you have an 85% African-American city, then you should have that reflected in the dollars that are being spent in your city. And saying this was unpopular at the time. I cut the city's budget. You know, we had an immense budget. We had 21,000 employees when I came in. When I left, we had just under 15,000. So I was the person that had to come in and get the budget in line. But I was a political figure that was always controversial in the city. And so when I gave them the rope, people thought it an opportunity to get rid of me. And everything that happened was the first time. It was unprecedented. For first, the prosecutor to even charge criminally. I was the first person to go to jail for this. We couldn't even find another case in America that was similar to mine. And it was all in this complex, horrible, ugly race history of the city of Detroit. And it's so unfortunate because Detroit has not recovered since this happened.
We're talking with Kwame Kilpatrick, the former mayor of the city of Detroit. He has been referred to, at least during his tenure, as the hip-hop mayor. And we're talking about his book, Surrender. Do you believe that the city would have been better off if you were still mayor today?
Well, absolutely. And I think Detroit is still that. I think a lot of them at the time, 3.5 years ago when this was going on, probably felt different because of the immense media that was behind getting me out. But they all feel it now. I mean, we built more houses, fixed more streets, fixed more parks than any administration in the history of the town.
The city of Detroit has been, and I suppose is, in dire straits. I mean, when you go to Detroit, you see lots of urban decay and ruin.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a great town, great people. But, you know, that bickering and arguing, that hatred, that anger, it continues to force the city into positions where it can never be successful. And that's so unfortunate because it's such a great American city. I mean, Stanley, we're talking about the city that put the world on wheels, the kind of revolutionary insight that gave people the Motown sound. I mean, that spirit, the remnant of it is still there. But with all of that overwhelming hate and bitterness.
Now, when you talk about hate and bitterness and anger, are you talking about racism?
Oh, absolutely. You know, United States Census called the Detroit metropolitan area, I don't know if you noticed, the most racially segregated region of the country. It's always been a very pivotal place for civil rights and race in America, and most people don't recognize how overwhelming the presence of hatred and race is in the Detroit conversation, the Detroit environment, and Detroit atmosphere.
Well, with that sort of ingrained hatred and racism and turmoil that you describe, how did you actually become the mayor? I mean, that seemed to be against the odds in the first place.
Because in Detroit also, it's this dynamic love. And that's what I talked about that in the book. You know, KwameKilpatrickBook.com, I think that the constant a war between the incredible love and creativity and dynamism of the city is something that should be studied. I mean, how did I win? Because I grew up in Detroit where Coleman Alexander Young, the first African American mayor of Detroit, he won in 1973. And, you know, I was born in 1970. So basically that was the only mayor I knew for 20 years. And he was the person who I just wanted to be like. And I used to read books. At 8 years old, I declared I would be mayor. And so it's that same love. It's that same community that remembers, you know, that I used to tell them, they told me to stay off their grass, but do my homework. And I could be anything that I want to be. And it's that same community where a black boy can grow up and believe he could be anything, doctor, lawyer, architect. Because Detroit, Stanley, is also the city in America that had more black architects than any other city, more black engineers, black mayor. Black. So you saw black from the biggest house in the city of Detroit to the smallest shack. There was a black man. And so when I grew up, I saw people with suits and ties on, you know, hats on, you know, Borsalinos and Gators. The black men that I saw went to work every day. My grandfather worked at the post office 40 years. And so I grew up with a sense of pride and a sense of determination that said that we can win as a community if we work together. And it's that spirit that propelled me into that position.
Do you think we're going to see a turnaround in the city of Detroit?
I believe that when Detroiters start to believe again in themselves, yes. And I say that because the victimization type of attitude that has taken hold in the city is holding the citizenry up from becoming all that they can be. You know, I was in a tiny cell on a cement floor in a cell so small, Stanley, that I could touch all four walls sitting on my bunk. I was being fed through a slot in the door three times a day, and I was being handcuffed and taken to a shower three times per week. But the revelation is there are things that you must go through to get to God's ultimate purpose for your life. And even when I was in prison, I started to tutor young people on the GED test, and I eventually got a job at the prison school. And so I started my career coming out of Florida A&M University. I started my career as a Detroit public school teacher. Years later, after falling down, to start to get back up, I was back in the classroom in front of young guys teaching them reading, writing, and arithmetic. And it was in that moment that I had a revelation that this is what I was supposed to do. I had to come this way. I had to do this to get to where I've got to go. And so the revelation is, even if you've fallen down, even if you've gone through hell and high water, it's now time for you to take your second chance, for you to take your second act of life, your sequel. And it will happen the way God intends for it to happen. Get up.
Excellent. Short version, where does Kwame Kilpatrick go from here? I mean, your political career is over, probably not a realistic goal for a corporate career. What are you going to be doing?
No, I don't want to go into corporate career. I mean, I can start my own corporation, but but to go in somebody else's corporation as a job, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be elected anymore. I like the freedom. I think that elected officials are mostly managers. I respect them. I love them. I cherish the friendships that I have with them, but I've never felt the kind of freedom that I feel now. And I've been elected since I was 25 years old. And I'm 41 now. And so what I'm doing now is sharing my testimony around the country with anybody who will listen. And then secondly, I've started a company that we're taking a new revolutionary approach to correctional education. Just so you know, Stanley, 2.3 plus million people are behind bars, women and men, now in America. That doesn't even include the 9 million people that are in the county jail systems of America. 700,000 of them are getting out of prison every single year, federal and state prisons. And within 3 years, 75% of them go back. If we don't do something about what people are doing while they're doing their time, if we don't give them a quality education, if we don't lift them up while they're trapped in those institutions, we won't have an African-American community or any community of color or even a country. And so I believe that public service doesn't start and end with being elected or in politics, and I'm serving in a different way through this whole new approach, whole new curriculum, and revolution, I believe, in correctional education.
All right, you, sir, are a great man. I've had a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for being with us.
Hey, thanks a lot, Stanley. Appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, we've been talking with Kwame Kilpatrick, former mayor of Detroit, about his book, Surrender, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of Kwame Kilpatrick. We'll be right back after this break. We're going to be going to the roundtable here on the Ink Spot. We're going to invite on the roundtable Mary Mitchell from the Chicago Sun-Times, as well as Gerard McClendon, host of Off 63rd with Gerard McClendon. We'll be right back. Mary, what do you think about the book, Surrendered?
Let me tell you first what I liked about the book. Anytime someone writes a memoir, it really gives you a better insight into, you know, the circumstances of that person's life. And at the end of it, what you want people to do is to be inspired and motivated. So I think that he accomplished that. But I also think that this was a cautionary tale of what it means to be a young black man who is very, very talented and who had great opportunity, and what it means to fall from grace. Many of us have done it, so, you know, that's not unusual that people fall from grace, but fall from grace publicly and then having to put the pieces of one's life back together. Frankly, I was impressed at the end of this book that he even survived all of this.
Okay, Gerard, what do you think of Surrendered?
I really think that I do agree with Mary. I think that the book was somewhat of not necessarily a bird's eye view, but was almost as if I was reading a diary as I'm reading this book. I mean, I've really got to know a little bit more about Kwame Kilpatrick from a personal side. And although I went into the book, you know, accusing him, I looked at him from a demonizing point of view because of what I had read in the press. I saw the human being, I saw the man after I read the book. My point of view really didn't change of Kwame Kilpatrick, but I do respect him as a human being, not necessarily as a politician, and not necessarily as a man of moral fiber.
But I think that's good, though, because if, based on what you said, I think that he accomplished his goal. One of the things that he mentioned throughout the book is that he wanted people to hear his side of the story. He wanted to let people know who he was, opposed to what people have been hearing out there in the media.
Okay, yeah. But see, here's the problem with that, or any type of memoir, it's credibility. Mm. Of course he wants people to understand his side of it. And so
are you questioning his credibility?
Well, I think you should question his credibility. I mean, after all, the many of the things that he was accused of doing, he did. And the book he admitted doing, he admitted having the affair, he admitted being foolish enough to not take care of follow the probation that he was granted, the guidelines of probation. He admitted that he foolishly disregarded that. He admitted his mistakes. But what I mean by credibility is that when you are under attack by the media because of negative stories, what you want to do is defend yourself against that. And so all throughout this book, that's what he did. I mean, there was two targets in this book. One, yes, he did explain and get his point of view out, but one was the theme over and over again was the media lied or were inaccurate or were unfair to him, or two, the criminal justice system was unfair to him. Now, those are two popular notions. You know, worse than, I think even more than politicians, people hate journalists.
So you talk about journalists, you talk about the media. I agree that there was some things that that came across about in relation to the media. One of the things that he pointed out in the book, I'm assuming that this statistic bears out, and that is that he said the sales when he was going through his ordeal, whenever his name or likeness appeared on the front page of the newspaper, sales jumped up 7 to 12% every time. Now, you are a media individual. Gerard, you're in the media. What about that? Can you deny that maybe media will play a part in overhyping these types of situations?
It is what it is, though. I mean, come on. Kwame Kilpatrick was trying to be a rock star. He wasn't trying to be a responsible mayor of Detroit. I mean, he's cute. He's tall. He's big. He's a very attractive figure. He's extremely intelligent, I believe. I think he's articulate. But come on, when you get to the point where you're sexting your assistant and you don't think you're going to get caught, I mean, when you consistently deny that you've thrown these elaborate parties, when you've been bugged by the feds for taking a $10,000 bribe just a few months ago, come on, Kwame.
Here's the thing. Let's get back to the question that you're asking about whether or not it's possible, or do we believe that that writers and editors would play a story really big because it sells papers? Of course. This is the reason why every Monday the newspaper is wrapped in the Bears when they're winning.
Yes.
And that people are selling and picking up a lot of papers when the Bears win. It's the reason why when President Barack Obama was running for office, he was always on the front page of the newspaper, because people were interested in that. And here's the thing about the media. Everyone hates the media when it's a scandalous story, and they love us when they want us to tell their story. So he used the media to become the person that we knew as Kwame Kilpatrick, the youngest mayor ever elected in the nation.
Yeah, the hip-hop mayor.
Right. He loved that. So yeah. So when we are working, when the media is giving you positive coverage and putting that and building who you are, you cannot get to the heights that he arrived at without the media.
It can happen to almost anyone. You get caught up when circumstances and immaturity blend. Some very, very bad things can happen, and this is what happened to Kwame Kilpatrick.
So,
I mean, the poor guy. I mean, here, you know, he's the hip hop mayor of Detroit, not knowing that every tweet, text message, email that he sends out to the person who he's trying to court that's not his wife, he doesn't think that that's public domain. I mean,
and
you know, that's exactly right.
And here's a man whose mother is an experienced and polished politician, so it's not like he came from outside of the system and didn't know any of this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, he knows how vicious politics can be. So I just found that interesting. So, and the second thing is that the title of the book, The Rise, Fall, and Revelation, you know, I didn't get the feeling in this book that he really clearly took personal responsibility for his own downfall.
Well,
he kept coming back to other people.
You think he was just paying lip service? Because he did say throughout the book that he was responsible. It was his own immaturity that led to his downfall.
But he couched that with the media did this to him. The media lied. The media was inaccurate. The media was unfair. The court was unfair. The prosecutors were unfair. The judge was unfair. The police officers were unfair. The people that used to be his friends were unfair. I mean, all of that to me just says you still haven't taken responsibility for your role in it. Yes, he got a chance to tell a story, and yes, he did. I do think it was lip service at this point.
I agree with you, Mary.
Too much time blaming and pointing out the failures of the system. He opened his book with the failures of the criminal justice system, basically, that he was in jail and now he's in this position and he's looking around with all these black men and as if somebody outside of themselves put them and locked them up for no reason.
Hmm.
So I think that the hard part for me, the book, I would have felt better at the end of the book if I got the sense of I'm just telling it like it is. This is how you rise and you fall. And you learn from it.
Yeah.
Not what everybody else did. We already know that. You've been saying that. We've heard that. He said that when he was going through the process, that all these people were unfair to him. I want to know, I really wanted to walk away from this book feeling that there is, at the end of the day, this young man had redemption.
So you didn't get that feeling. How about you, Gerard? What do you think? Did you?
This book really could have been a great book if he would have totally come clean, if he would have said, this is not a memoir for Kwame Kilpatrick, but this is a memoir for those who may consider going down this path. I mean, almost Solomon-like, if we look at a biblical situation. I mean, here's a man who's wearing two-toned fedoras, sharkskin suits. I mean, he's drawing attention to himself while he's in office. And you're already a black man who's tall, you're young, you're fresh, you're vibrant. You know that you're under the microscope.
Well, you know,
in this book, he does not come totally clean.
Well, I'm going to say this on his behalf. Even though he did not come totally clean, we've only got a couple of minutes left on the show, and as you guys know, we need to get a thumbs up or thumbs down on this book. But on his behalf, I'm going to say that he did accomplish some great things as mayor, as he mentioned in the book, as he mentioned earlier when we were doing the interview, in terms of some of the rebuilding that he has done that hadn't taken place in that city in decades. So for that, I'm going to give him kudos, but I want to find out from you guys, thumbs up or thumbs down. Mary Mitchell, Chicago Sun-Times, do you give the book Surrendered by Kwame Kilpatrick a thumbs up or a thumbs down?
Oh, I give it a thumbs up. I think that I want people to be able to pick up this book and read it because I want to see this man go on with his life and actually, you know, walk into a new direction and have a life. I don't think that what happened to him should destroy him or his family. So, yes, I give it a thumbs up. People should read it.
Gerard McClendon, Off 63rd, the Emmy Award-winning program. Thumbs up or thumbs down to the book Surrendered?
Oh, man, Surrendered. I give Kwame Kilpatrick a thumbs up. I'm praying for the brother. I think that he can be redeemed. The book itself, thumbs down.
All right, I'm going to give Surrendered a thumbs up. I thought the book was great. I thought that Kwame Kilpatrick was forthright in the book. I thought that he gave us some very good inside information in terms of some of his thinking and some of the things that was going on. It seemed like a chronological journey into his rise and his fall. Mary, thank you for being here on the Ink Spot.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Gerard, thanks for being here. Spend some time with us.
I appreciate you. Thank you, Stanley.